Hello, and welcome to Book Reviews Kill, a podcast about fantasy, sci-fi, and horror novels. I'm Evan.
And I'm Chad.
And you're joining us today for our recap and discussion of Memories of Ice, Volume 3 of the Malazan Book of the Fallen by Stephen Erickson. Today we will be covering Book 1 of Memories of Ice, The Spark and the Ashes. I mentioned this in the Monday episode, but damn, this felt like Gardens of the Moon 3.0. We got lots of the same characters whom I wanted to see them again after Gardens of the Moon. We're back on Genabacus. Bunch of cool magic stuff happening. It's a total party of ascendants and near ascendants, and of course, giant lizards with swords for arms.
Man,
don't forget them.
Man, so cool. I love the cadence. Do you say Mali or Mal in your head?
I said in my head, I say Kashain Shamail. I think it's Kashain Shamale.
I think that's right, but yeah. I think Maul like sounds cooler to me, you know?
Kashain Shamal.
Yeah, Kashain Shamal. Kind of, yeah. Unless it's like a tiny lilt Kashain Shamal. And you like you kind of slide off that E, you know?
I think that's part of the fun of Malazan, you know? You kind of just pronounce stuff the way you pronounce stuff in your
totally.
Head. But I really loved this book. I didn't like it as much as any of the books in Deadhouse Gates, but I liked it as much as a couple of the books in Gardens of the Moon, and definitely more than a couple of the books in Gardens of the Moon as well. So,
right. And when we say book, we mean that little yep. section that the volume of yes. one manuscript from cover to cover is containing.
I think everybody's probably pretty on. This is the 9th episode, I think, or the 8th episode.
I forget sometimes, so yeah, I'm just throwing out a little reminder for the people.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think about this book? I mean, I think that some of it was definitely a little bit over my head. I felt a little more confused than I did really at any part during Deadhouse Gates. But those confused parts were definitely pretty few and far between. I felt like, especially with like Chapter 6, where it was all Gruntal, I mean, I felt like I really just kind of that was a banger chapter. It was really, really good.
Coming off the back end of this huge, complicated, like very
busy. Chapter 5 was rough.
Busy. Yeah, chapter 5 was pretty rough.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll say that, you know, in my notes here, when the summary section ends, it's labeled talking points, and that's never been truer than with this part, because it was just, we do have some cool like stuff with the guards, but it was a lot of talking, some really interesting talking between some really interesting characters who I want to be around more as they're talking, but like, man, sometimes it was like two people talk and then two people talk over here, then two people talk over here, then three people talk over here. And then, you know, Wiki jumps in front and saves like a 10-year-old girl from just being killed by Kalor, this guy.
We need to talk about Kalor.
Need to talk about Kalor. Yeah, I got opinions.
Let's just jump right into the recap, and then we can get into some of the things that I think I've got a handle on and then some other questions that I have for you.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I've got some questions for you too.
I do want to say for this episode in particular, and probably most of the first episodes we do for each of these volumes going forward, there's just a lot of questions that Chad and I are going to have that we're probably not super going to answer in a very satisfying way either, just because there's so many read and find out things. This is the first book in this third volume. There's so many more episodes ahead of us, but this series in particular, there's just so many things that are, we just don't know, you know?
It's not even sometimes it is an information problem like that, like you're saying, but sometimes it's an interpretation problem. Like the way that these books are written, like if you listen to this, be like, no, you're just not very intelligent and you're justifying, like, no, I'm telling you can read a chapter and a certain event and it can be interpreted in like multiple ways. Sometimes it's kind of parabolic, like it's parables, little stories within stories, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
And before we move on, this, I was watching a interview with Stephen Erickson, and having this in my head really helped me kind of enjoy and better consume his content. And he said that he writes each chapter as a completed short story. He thinks of each chapter as its own little short story. And yes, in service to the overall larger story, because it kind of has to be, but that's how he's shaping it, which is why sometimes from chapter to chapter, you have very like disparate like themes and feelings, like really lighthearted, really deep, really. And it's because he's trying to make each chapter its own self-contained story, or at least have an element of that.
What a cool way to go forward, you know, as we're still kind of early on in the series. I'll try to keep that in mind.
It really helped, because sometimes you're just like, what? Like, though someone should tell him, stop writing short stories, you're writing a long story. So maybe write it like a long story, bro.
I think we can defer to Stephen Erickson. He probably knows what he's
probably
doing. All right, let's do the recap.
Okay, let's do it.
The prologue opens with a flashback to the Middle Paleolithic era, this world's Middle Stone Age, 300,000 years before the current time. It is the 33rd Jagut War, and we follow an Amas Bonecaster as she saves two Jagut children from being killed by an Amas hunting group. The Jagut children's mother was desperate for a safe place to hide them, so she makes a deal with a lone Amas who finds the fleeing Jagut family before their hunters do. The Amas takes pity, as she recently was with child herself. She takes the children, leaving the mother, who is quickly found and killed, but not before gloating to her killers about the Amas who saved her Jagut children, and are even now about to be put through a local warren gate, out of reach of the Amas and back with their own kind. As she was told by the rogue Amas that a gate to a Jagut warren is nearby, and once inside, they will be out of reach of the Amas hunters. The Amas have enough mercy to allow her to die in ignorance of the truth and swiftly kill her after she tells them this. They rush after the renegade child saver, as not even they wish the fate of going through that warren upon the kids. They know what she, nor the children's Amas savior, does not. The warren gate does not lead to one of the Jagut warrens in safety, but actually belonged to the ancient Kachain Shamal, and currently it is locking away a creature of terrible power from ravaging the world. The two Amas hunters catch up to the renegade a tiny bit too late to prevent her from pushing these children through the warren and inform her of her mistake. Not only did that act release an ancient powerful something upon the land, but also resigned the children to a life of pain, living on for eternity in immeasurable agony with no hope of rescue. A crueler fate could not be found anywhere. We learn this renegade, and ultimately unhelpful and accidentally wildly cruel, Amas is the sister to Tul. She is, of course, distraught, unable to fathom the lives of eternal suffering she has submitted the children to. Undoubtedly, the most awful way to learn that the road of good deeds is paved by the eternal torment of innocent lives. We are then shown to a time when three elder gods converge on King Kalor to punish him for his crimes. In a disgusting turn, Kalor, who wished to spite the elder gods, had recently incinerated 12 million slaves, turning them to ash. To pay for his crimes, the gods curse him forever to live as an old man, never able to reach ascendancy. As with violence, curses beget curses, and Kalor curses each one in return for being cursed by them. Kurul, opener of paths, is to be forgotten by the mortal world. Draconis will be destroyed by his own creation. Sister of the Cold Knights is fated to become a middling sorcerer, walking amongst mortals, who will eventually be ripped apart by enemies on a battlefield, never to know respite. A wounded Tog in the form of a large wolf watches from afar. The elder gods then all set to work cleaning what they may of the remains of Kalor's genocide, placing his victims' remains into a warren that would one day become what is known today as the Imperial Warren. To this day, when traveling its dark paths, one must do so ankle deep in the ash of millions. Thus we arrive at the beginning of the book, one of four, in Memories of Ice, the third installment in Stephen Erikson's Malazan Book of the Fallen, The Spark, and The Ashes. The book begins 2 months after the events of Gardens of the Moon, an eventful fate of the late Lady Simtal. Tok the Younger awakens, confused and alone. He sees a tower in the distance with a red, pulsing wound close by it. As he goes closer to investigate, he meets Anos T'Ulin, Tul, who is awaiting Lady Envy, who arrives at the tower shortly after. She mentions the Rend and a bit of its history, informing us the creature that was freed was a Kachain Shamal matron. After replenishing supplies, they decide to travel together, each wanting to join the forces. Dujek and Kaladin Brood lead as they join their strength in preparation for the eventual confrontation of the Panian Daman. Lady Envy travels with a dog named Gareth, an A named Baljag, and three Segula warriors, Mok, Thrul, and Senu. Mok is ranked very highly amongst the Segula, and leads a punitive army against the Panian Seer. On the way, Tok and Tul bond over making arrows. Lady Envy tries to flirt with Tok, much to his dismay, and the Segula, excluding Mok, attempt to challenge Tul to single combat. Both are defeated easily, Tul slapping them to the ground in disdain with the flat of his blade, a flinty gleam in his eye. Get it? His blade was made from flint? You get it. Gruntal is a Daru caravan guard, currently working as one of the protectors of a small caravan alongside his friends Harlow and Stony Manakis. They are escorting a mysterious figure named Karuli to Capistan. On the way, they meet two strange and seemingly fickle sorcerers named Bouchelain and Corbel Broach, who say they're traveling to Capistan on a whim. Buke, another one of Gruntal's friends, claims that they're responsible for several murders in Darujastan, and decided to join their caravan as a guard, but really he's hoping to kill them or die trying. On the way to Capustan, they stop at Sal Toon, where Karuli tries to bolster the defenses against the growing danger of the Panion Seer through disinformation and propaganda. As they leave, they meet Hitan, Kefal, and Natok, three Barghast warriors from the Whiteface clan who claim to be hunting demons. They decide to join forces for their mutual protection. Bouchelaine and Corbel Broach, with the help of a Barghast shaman now confined to a stick snare, think Hairlock from Book 1, find Gruntal's caravan and warn them that the demons are coming. As they prepare for battle, Karuli determines that the demons are actually undead K'chain Shamal Kel hunters, things not seen on the earth for thousands of years. In the ensuing battle, Harlow and Gruntal are struck down, our vision fading along with Gruntal's, his fate unknown. The child born from the efforts of Karul, Pran Shol, and Krupp, who, during the Gardens of the Moon, hoped to save the soul of Tattersail via reincarnating her, is now living amongst the Riffi. She is named Silver Fox and has grown at an incredibly fast rate. She appears to be 10 years old, despite only being a few months since her mother, a Riffi woman known as the Meeb, gave birth to her. Silver Fox grows rapidly ignorant that her rapid growth is powered by stealing her mother's youth. The girl reveals that within her are the reborn souls of both Tattersail and Nightchill, though their desperate personalities take turns coming to the forefront and create an interesting and confusing person seemingly at odds with herself at times. Silver Fox also claims to be a flesh and blood bone caster of the Talon Imas, and says she will summon them to help with the war against the Panion Damen. Bridgeburners, Corporal Picker and Blend, posted on the hills to ward off smugglers, catch an old man sneaking amongst the rocks, claiming his name to be Munug, an artisan and trader from Darujastan who is traveling to Pale. Corporal Picker purchases his most valuable piece, three interlocking torques blessed at a newly erected temple of Tretch. Picker later receives some flack from Quick Ben, who chastises Picker for getting torques blessed by an insane god who hasn't shifted out of Soul-Taken form for hundreds of years. We follow Munug as he sneaks off into a warren, to a ragged hide tent containing a sickly and coughing crippled god waiting within. He delivers a new deck of freshly carved cards that he crafted depicting images of flaws, imperfection, pain, anguish, and loneliness. All things which please the god. Suffering is how he receives worship, after all. As payment, the god cures Munug of his tumors in his legs by making them dead. As if we had any doubt that making a deal with ascendants is a dangerous game, and to be avoided at all costs, especially one would think to a god whose worship is literal suffering of mortals. With these cards, a new game is begun. Kaladin Brood and the Rivi are headed south to parlay with the outlawed Molazan rebel army to unite against the Panion Damen, a theocratic empire devouring cities one by one, seemingly unstoppable. Their manic extremism has created dark rumors of horrific deeds done by their troops and stories of soulless children who are born after battle and through some dark magic inhabit the bodies of the fallen. With each city the Panion Damen capture, their ranks swell. Their attack strategy is described as a plague of hungry mouths, mindless in its lust for destruction, pitiless as it expands, devouring city after city. The armies of Dujek Onearm and Kaladin Brood meet, and their alliance is solidified. During a small get-together with the leaders of the various forces joined against the Panion Seer, it is determined that their first stop should be Capustan to relieve the Grey Swords, and their ultimate destination should be Coral to fight the Panion Damen at its home base. Like a weed, some things must be exterminated at their root. No trace allowed to remain to pervert and infect the holy. Rumors. Like a weed, some things must be exterminated at their root. No trace allowed to remain to pervert and infect the holy. Rumors are passed around that the Panion Damen use a horde of starving peasants known as the Tenascauri, who have perpetrated horrible crimes, cannibalism merely an appetizer to the dinner of their foul and horrific deeds. The Council of Darujastan arrives, including Cole, Murillo, Astrasian D'Arl, and the magnanimous Krupp, who promises to aid the armies by providing supply lines and material through the Trigall Trade Guild. Whiskey Jack, still nursing a badly healed leg after the fate, decides to stand in defense of Silver Fox along with Korlat. Kalor declares her to be evil and admonishes all to kill her before she becomes too powerful, and betrays them all. but many oppose him, and the situation culminates with Whiskey Jack drawing his sword and standing in between the girl and Kalor, implying anyone who wished to harm the 10-year-old girl will have to get through him first. The situation is diffused, with Silver Fox remaining alive and Kalor fuming, obviously not getting his way. Ganoa's Perrin, traveling with the Bridgeburners, has been feeling ill and suffering from nightmare visions since his contact with the Hounds of Shadow and the events of the Fate in Daruristan. Mallet and Quick Ben determine that he is on the cusp of ascendancy, and his resistance to it is causing him to feel sick. Silver Fox declares him to be a new, unaligned card in the deck of dragons, the master of the deck. A table made by the Bridgeburner specifically for the deck of dragons is discovered in Kaladin Brood's possession, with Perrin's face painted on it. Upon seeing it, Perrin is transported to the finessed house from where he travels to the Beasthold and finds two empty thrones. He also sees that Byrne is wounded with a shrunken, hooded figure chained to the wound. Silver Fox says that a war has begun against the Warrens themselves, and that Perrin is essential to winning this war. Perrin is certain he'll fail. Quick Ben is proving himself integral in the day-to-day operations of Dujek's army, acting as his second-in-command with duties touching upon bureaucracy, communications networks, depail, tithes, and tariffs, and a general maintaining of control. He is highly suspicious of the outlawing of Dujek and the Bridgeburners decreed by Empress Lassine, and ever wary, frees his soul from his body and goes a-warren hopping, following the tracker he had cleverly placed in Munug's pack. He also comes across the crippled god. They fight, Quick Ben unleashing his seven warrens and floods the tent with fire. Kurul fights back and Quick Ben is quickly hard-pressed, but is saved by a giant hand as it reaches from the earth, pulling him down through layers of dirt and rock into a cavernous dome tunnel that is Burn's body. White arcs like ribs hold up the roof. Diamond-speckled clay creatures, 15 times the size of a man, hold up the roof. The giant with diamond-like eyes and childlike voice begs QB to help them. Their mother weakens, and the crippled god's poison sloughs their clay flesh. Byrne sleeps to dream, and her dreams have become fevered. He realizes that if Byrne dies, all of humanity will be in danger. He vows to save Byrne, and find a way to thwart the crippled god. The witch promises to help. Quick Ben leaves by Warren, leaving a tracking stone so he can find his way back again. Anamander Rake and Kaladin Brood discuss that they, along with other Ascendants, were responsible for the chaining, thinking it was the only feasible solution at the time. Both the crippled god and the sorcerers of the Panion Domin use the Warrens of Chaos. Rake doesn't think that this is a coincidence. If Byrne dies, her warren will be the pathway to the other warrens, and the crippled god will destroy them, and as a result, he will destroy all magic. The destruction, Brood suggests, won't stop there.
All right, so many things happened. As I predicted, so many things would happen.
Dude, so many things happened. Lots of talking, and you know, as I read that recap, maybe I hyperbolized the talking a little bit. Maybe it wasn't that much, because there were some awesome things that happened as well. Let's begin right with the beginning, with the fact
prologue?
That Stephen Eric, yeah, the prologue, okay, where he comes out swinging, and before the book even begins, yeah, we've got 12 million people dead, 300,000 years ago. We've got two children going into eternal suffering. Like, he really...
Allegedly. Like, are they in eternal suffering?
Oh, for sure.
Because she thought she put them into the Umtos Felek Warren.
Right.
But then, was it Pron Cole that came up and was like, hey, whoa, what did you... Do you know where you just sent them?
Totally. I mean, and by doing that, not only are these kids subjected to an eternal lifetime of suffering, but she also released the thing that was being held within that Warren, which was the T'Chain Shamal Matron Mother.
The K'Chain Shamal Matron Krell warriors kind of come up in the very end of this chapter with Gruntal and everything too. So like that
yeah.
is definitely, that's all kind of, I feel like it, with this chapter, excuse me, this book of this volume, I feel like a lot more things were kind of like mentioned and then we got to hear about them again, which I feel like with Malazan so far that kind of happens, but it's like 700 pages later. But with this, it was like, okay, so like Kalor, cool, like that's a thing. Oh, Kron Chol, like that's a thing, totally. Like, oh, that was in Gardens of the Moon with Kroll and everything, like and Krepa and stuff. Like, I feel like as we start getting more into these books, I'm starting to really see, and even them like mentioning, not them, but even Ralak Nam and that woman that he was with in the Azeth House in the Finest, it was just nice to kind of revisit that and be like, oh, I totally know. I remember what that was. I totally remember what was going on there. And then in this book specifically, I feel like we got a lot more kind of like nods and mentions of characters and a lot more kind of like throwback stuff to the prologue. Like the prologue was like really relevant, even though while I was reading it, I was like, what the hell is going on right now?
Like, right. At first I was like, oh, we need a statute of limitations here, man, on revenge stories. Cause like, wow. Like he just has no restraint, you know. He's just like 300,000. He was like 150. No, 300,000.
300,000 years.
Probably because he had all of the history of the continent mapped out already between now and then. So he's like, that was the next available date, you know.
I really liked that conversation in the very, very, very beginning of the book where they're looking at these like, what are they, like tar pits or something? I'm kind of overloaded with information right now, but you get the gist of what I'm saying. There's like these animals that are trapped in this like miasma, like this tar pit kind of, that's how totally. I pictured it in my head. I think it was Prenchol that was talking to another Talanamas, and they were basically saying like, oh, like we are the like the tar basically, and those animals that are caught inside of it are the Jagu, you know.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting. It was like such an interesting way to start the entire book off. What'd you think about the prologue? I mean, do you feel like you understood it? Do you feel like it was really relevant and you're happy that it was there, or did it just kind of throw you off? What were your thoughts?
See, what did it give me? It set up the Kachin Shamal, though it sets them up in a very weird way, and that like, well, are we not suffering the like result? Well, like what's going to happen because this matron was released? And is that now just happening? Like the Kachin Shamal that we got attacked by, and this one, the ones that were released back then? Because like it seems like, what were they doing for the last 300,000 years? Or maybe it's just establishing the idea that they're still around.
I don't
away.
Think that the Krell warriors are Kachin Shamal. I could be wrong.
Oh, okay.
I think they're undead. There's like a necromancer type situation.
They are undead. You're right.
On.
You're
but
totally right.
I don't
right.
know if they are, because I've never seen Kachin Shamal before. I don't know what they actually look like. I in my mind, they were like a different race of Krell warriors being controlled by a Kachin Shamal matron or somebody
totally
connected
right.
to that matron.
I think they're undead.
Totally. They are undead. I know that for sure. I don't know if Kachin Shamal don't typically have swords for arms, but they do look like dinosaurs.
Right. Like,
or,
did they grow that way?
I don't know. Or just the Krell warriors have swords for arms. I don't know. Yeah. And they are also Kachin Shamal. Like a Krell warrior is a Kachin Shamal, but a Kachin Shamal isn't necessarily
sure,
a Krell
sure,
warrior
sure.
with swords for arms. So,
okay, question for you on the prologue here. What do you think Steven Erikson, like, we've obviously had been introduced to themes of like massive like sadness and overwhelming length of agony, and like to be reminded about it and such, like it seemed weird that like he would be like, hey, look, there's still good in the world. This one Imas, who was like, I used to be pregnant so I can empathize, I'm gonna take your babies, you'll still die. Then she thinks she's doing a good act, but really she releases a bad creature, hope we think, onto the earth, and then suffers these two children for like eternal damnation. And it just seems like sometimes even good deeds result in like hellish things. Like, I don't really know what point he's making, because that he hasn't already made in abundance, you know.
I mean, I think the key part of what your question is the that he hasn't already made in abundance. Like, I mean, I think at this point we are being beaten over the head with it. I mean, it's yeah. definitely, I get it, Steven Erikson.
Right, like, wow.
I mean, I think to answer your question, if I could, like, I mean, this series is, it's not a story. You know, it's a lot of stories. It's hundreds of stories. It's totally. Thousands of stories. And I think like he's trying to communicate a whole bunch of stuff with this prologue, but I think maybe
okay, no, that
one
helped.
Of the things that's trying to be communicated is like, this is a full, we have to really consider the breadth of time we're dealing
right.
with, you know, and especially, I mean, because the Talanamas are being kind of like drawn to Silver Fox, like a lodestone, it seems, at least that's what
I got that idea too.
So I think that with that in mind, like, okay, so let me see if I can get this right. So the Logros Talanamas were the only ones that were fighting for Kelenved before.
I believe that's correct.
It sounds like there are more clans that are coming to Silver Fox now. So I think that what Erikson is trying to do is trying to kind of like give us a little bit of backstory with the Talanamas.
Okay.
And say like, look, these are like way different things.
They come from a totally different era.
Exactly. And they've been around for 300,000 years
and they're still around.
In a sense, they've been around
totally.
In certain
okay.
ways that I don't really understand. Like they're like dust sometimes, and they're in and out of warrens and stuff. And I don't really know anything about the Talanamas.
Seems like their body didn't agree to like the forever thing, because they didn't go forever, right?
They
it's
had,
discussed
like, a weird
that they
ritual.
Did a
yeah.
ritual. Yeah.
yeah.
I also found it funny that, well, maybe not funny, but interesting how a couple thousand, 100,000 years of like eternal war will really wear you down. Because she like mentions the renegade Imas is T'Ulin's sister, T'ul's sister. Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, he'll be, Anos T'Ulin will be like satisfied, or he'll be stoked because he's in support of this like thing where we get to live forever and then have a forever war. And well, that's not the T'ul that we meet. He seems a little worn down, you know?
Yeah, I love how moving on a little bit when Tok wakes up, which I kind of had a hazy memory of Tok not being dead, but it was just so cool. He's just like, oh, holy shit. Like, remember that weird being thrown into a warren by Herlock? Like,
he just got
where
poofed.
Am I? Yeah. But then him kind of just coming across T'ul, just like laying on the ground, which the image of that, it's just like, I just really like that image so much. He's just like, oh,
like, out of nowhere. I don't know, because sometimes we're reminded things just like happen for random, and then something like that didn't seem random at all, because like he just stumbled into like this meeting of things. And how long had T'ul been waiting for Lady Envy to show up?
Okay, some of this book I've got pretty locked down. Like, I feel like I understand what's going on. The stuff with Tok and Lady Envy and the those like three people with masks, the Segula, right. I think is what they're called.
You think they're like really good at sword fighters?
I don't know what the hell's going on in those parts.
Like,
I hope that it gets clear. Like, I mean, try as you might, ask me questions about it. I really don't understand what the point of all that is. Like, I know that Lady Envy is the daughter of the person that created Dragnipur, which is Anamander Rake's sword.
And Draconis was the name of the guy. And he's one of the he's one of the three gods that get cursed at the very beginning of this book by Kalor.
Now that we're bringing up the three gods that get
cursed, we're broadening fast.
I want to move on from the Tok stuff. I'm sure it's I'm sure it's important, but I can't resonate with it right now.
It's dusty. My mouth is dry.
Considering those three gods that get cursed by Kalor. So I want to talk about Kalor a little bit. I think that one of the reasons why Kalor is so much animosity towards Silver Fox is because Nightchill is one of those.
Oh, of course. And she's in there.
So,
totally,
we don't,
of course.
Know
yeah.
very much at all about Nightchill. And I can't
Nothing.
Think of like any other reason why. Like, Kalor like hates Silver Fox. Like,
totally.
Absolutely hates her.
And I mean, he hated all three gods. It said, despite the gods, he killed 12 million, or 28 million, 12 million slaves, I think. A lot of slaves. It was just despite the gods. Like, he did it despite them. So he must, like, pre-existing, even that point, hated them for some reason.
What is Kalor doing with Kaladin Brood?
I don't
understand, like,
leading?
What...
Whose troops are he leading?
I don't think Kalor has troops. He's just second in command.
Okay.
Like, I don't understand. If anybody in the Discord, without spoiling anything, maybe Chad and I just need to keep reading, but that was one of the things I was kind of hazy on. I was like, why is this guy here? Like, I don't understand.
You're right. He is second in command. That's confirmed.
Like, he must be formidable in his own way. Tactician. I don't know what word I've used. Tactitionally.
Yeah. I mean, you know, someone who's lived for thousands of years, you know, you would imagine would be a pretty good tactician.
Yeah, but like, Kaladin Brood doesn't seem to really like him. And not to mention, there are moments, I think wasn't there like a moment in Gardens of the Moon or something where Kalor had been like resentful to Brood for like Brood meeting up with the other guy or something happened?
I mean, Kalor's always going to be resentful because he can't ascend. He's stuck as an old man forever. Which seems like a distinction without a difference, kind of, because... Since I don't really understand ascendancy.
I think ascendancy carries with it a certain kind of power and privilege.
Okay. Maybe. Okay. Yeah. Like, you get a warren maybe and you can go beyond. But because he seems, I mean, he with a thought cursed the three gods in response. And like, what sort of power does he have to do that? How did he kill those slaves?
Know. Well, like, also.
How is he so powerful? When like Perrin is almost an ascendant, but he's not like blasting fires
really
across continents. Like, I don't know. It's weird power differentials here.
Is Perrin almost an ascendant because. Was it because like he was near all the magical stuff that was happening with Tattersail?
Yeah, and then the sword
like Kreppa
and Luck Opon.
Okay, is that why he's just like, is it is like a proximity thing?
I think it rubs off on you. Yeah. And like an Azath House thing. It's because it seems like Azath Houses are one of the ways that you can become an ascendant. Like Kellen Ved and Dancer, they went into the Azath House the Dead House, thank you, and that's how they became ascendant. That was like their was it Tremalor? Tremalor was on the other side. Whatever,
I have no idea. I'm so sorry. I'm trying.
Then
here.
Some people go through there and like fall asleep. There was a guy who fell asleep for all time who just by going in it, and then another group goes in just like uses a shortcut. So it really is The Azath House concept is seems to be the like.
I want to find out more.
The catch all for, sure. for like any time we need an answer or something, some way to have something made. We just like throw them in an Azath House and it knows what to do. It's like the Room of Requirement in that way.
Yeah, I mean, like Silver Fox, going back to Perrin. So Perrin's kind of dealing with, he's feeling sick, like he's feeling really awful, like just weird, which totally makes sense. I mean, like I feel like a lot of his thoughts are kind of consumed by like, what the hell did I throw those hounds into? You know what I mean? Like what the hell happened in Dragnifer? Like, I can't make heads or tails of it. And then also Silver Fox is like, hey, you are the master of the deck.
Right. Here's a carving of you on the bottom of this table. Like,
yeah. So like that was all. I think that's more read and find out kind of stuff.
I think
like,
so
I don't really
too.
Understand the significance of Perrin being the master of the deck. I don't know what that means. Like, I don't
right.
know.
Or even how it became
like,
a thing.
Why would it need a master at all? Like, it doesn't seem like it's had one. So,
right. Like, even in the normal deck of cards, there's like the king, but then there's the ace, there's a joker. It seems like I don't know. It's weird.
Well, it's funny too, because it kind of goes into detail that like the houses used to be called holds. They're the deck of dragons stuff. I'm like, just go with that. Let's just go with it.
Yeah, it's a way to just blast us in the face with esoteric information from time to time. You know, I will say on the topic
important,
of Perrin,
though.
They are important. It's a cool way to show us that greater things are happening without actually showing us, you know? Perrin is such a tragic character because, like, he's, like, genuinely trying, I feel like, anyway, he's genuinely trying to be the best man that he can be in the circumstances that he's with. And, like, his whole plan was to escape the shadow of his, like, merchant father, who was probably in it for the money. And he wanted to get out from under his father. And to his papa's great chagrin, chooses to go the way of the soldier. And then he's like, I will control my own destiny. My parents will not control me. And then like first move is like, boom, used by a god. Second move, boom, used by the adjunct. Yeah. And then a whole bunch more by the adjunct. And then he gets kind of a chance to spread his wings a little bit. And then like, boom, controlled by a god again. And then he gets his sword is being controlled by a god. And then he gets kind of like told, like, you're becoming a card. You're becoming an ascendant. And that's why you're sick. Because... your stomach eats itself when you're fighting your own destiny or something.
Yeah,
so he would rather have a tummy ache than like evolve into the immortal role of godhood, which might actually be the one thing that does give you the ability to truly have some autonomy to seize your own destiny, Mr. Perrin.
But think about all the experiences he's had with ascended and gods and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, why would he want to be one?
Be the change, Perrin, be the change. That's a good point, yeah.
Speaking of Silver Fox and that whole situation, Silver Fox is really interesting. I want to know so much more about what's going on here. Apparently, she's also a Talanimas bone caster as well.
How?
I don't know.
I don't get that at all.
You said how, so I don't know. I don't know. I think it's because of Pran Cole and Krull and Krupa's like influence with all of that. But I don't know exactly how. If anybody in the Discord wants to let Chad and I know, you know, it might be a read and find out kind of thing. But I also thought it was interesting that in order for her to get older as fast as she is, she's kind of sucking the life force out of like a basically like what mid-20s, like,
yeah, they call her the Mibe, the Meeb.
I think it's Mibe.
Mibe, okay. I think it's Mibe. Whatever. Super doesn't matter.
But yeah, I thought that was interesting. And then like Korlat, who. But by the way, real quick, all the K names, Erickson.
Bro, seriously.
So many. Anyway, I feel like every fantasy book is just like, we're going to pick a letter and we're just going to run with it.
Dude, because
it's fine. It's fine. We're just, we're never going to get out from under that umbrella.
At least it's
anyway.
Not A's, you know, because that's just lazy, dude. Like, come on, you can make about the A's.
The first letter.
Yeah, the first one.
Anyway, was Korlat the one that was kind of observing Apsalar and Crocus? When they were in like in Gardens of the Moon, when they were in Baruch's attic, remember? There's and then I think that she was kind of around a little bit for Quick Ben and Kalam, like going through the streets and like when they were, one of them was like invisible and stuff. I know that sounds really vague and kind of confused, but is that the same person? I think that is
totally. Yeah, she was sent by. She's one of the assassin mages that was sent by Rake originally.
Okay, cool.
And I think even one of the dragons that went and attacked Raced. Because like they're all I think there's not
really?
Very many of them in there. So I'm pretty sure she was.
Oh, I didn't put that together. That's cool.
One of the dragons. What was it? Selan? Selan? I think it was
Solana.
I think nice. So. That sounds right. That sounds right, dude. I'm killing it over here. What does she play in this role in this book? Where does she come in?
Okay, so she kind of hangs with the Mybe and with Silver Fox, and she's also kind of, she seems to be, in my mind, kind of like a liaison almost between like the remaining Talon and Mas, or excuse me, Tiste Andy, who...
Oh, I get too confused.
I know Talon and Mas and Tiste Andy are way too... They're in my mind is like
super different,
they're not
but they're
the same
just totally the same. Yeah, in my mind too.
I really dug how Erickson is really stressing how like hopeless of a race the Tistandi are. Like, it's really interesting. Like,
what's their thing? Tell me what you know about them, because I feel like I'm muddled a bit.
There seems to be like, wasn't there like something
they're the last ones?
Where it was, like, one of them died, and then somebody wanted to bury them, and they were like, why are you burying the dead? They're dead. Like, they're gone. Like, what are
totally.
You... Totally. They're like this kind of like, not wandering necessarily. I mean, I guess they kind of are if they're on Pale and they're kind of floating around, but they're kind of just like hopeless and sad and like kind of like locked in like this, I don't know, just like continuous like battle, like state of like battle and like just despair almost. At least that's what it seems like. And it's almost like this kind of like, well, we're here, we're going to fight because we're here and we're going to fight. And it's just like this kind of like tautology almost of their existence is one big tautology almost, it seems like, which is sad also. So I don't know. I think it's interesting. I feel like it sets the Tistand apart like a little bit from all the other races and just makes them that much more interesting and like makes Adamander Rake that much more interesting.
Totally. Yeah, I wonder. I would love to know his backstory, you know, because like the Tistandi, there's okay, always something very like, tragic about them. And like when Adamander Rake says in the Gardens of the Moon, like they're a dying race, but then right after that he talks about how he's unable to enliven them and give them like the zeal for life. So does he mean that they're dying like their numbers, or they're dying that they like have no zest for life anymore? Yeah. But like, do they have a country somewhere, or is there just like five of them?
It's not just five of them. There's a lot.
Okay. Like all on Moonspawn.
There's not like a ton of them, but there's a decent amount. I don't know what the raw numbers are for.
But they'd probably be Tistandi. On Moonspawn, because there's no like Tistandi land, right?
Did I say Pale earlier when I meant Moonspawn? I meant Moonspawn.
Oh, Pale, word. I didn't even get it. But yeah, good correction. Good correction.
I had to correct myself. Because if I hadn't corrected myself, then people would have been confused.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, no. And we're already confusing people enough, I'm sure. Where is Moonspawn during all this? We see Adamander Rake, but no Spawn. I'd be taking nothing everywhere.
Actually, that leads us nicely into the Gruntal stuff. So, like, Gruntal, when he meets Bausalane and
Corbolodom?
Corbolodom is in
you're right.
Death's Gates. I know. Bausalane and can't remember the other person's name. Corbel Bach or something like that. Gosh, why can't I remember his name? No, it's Corbel Broach. Yeah.
Corbel Broach. Sorry. There we go. Yep.
So when they first are introduced.
Some people have first names. Some people get last names too. Like, what the... Okay, you go on.
So when they're first introduced, they're kind of like, all this stuff happened over here a couple weeks ago or whatever. And then someone mentions Moonspawn, and then Gruntal's like, Moonspawn's right over there. See it? It's like over the mountains in the distance.
Oh, yeah. Kind of. Wow. That's funny. Where is that thing? Like, dude, it's literally like right there in the sky.
I can't remember if it was Gruntal that asked and that they showed him, or if it was the other way around. But yeah, the whole... Okay, so I really like Gruntal a lot.
Me too. Man, okay, which...
You sounded frustrated.
I did. I am. Well, more and more, I'm like respectfully frustrated because Steven Erickson has this really, really uncanny ability to spend just enough words with a character to really get me emotionally involved before he just kills him, you know? And it was just like, man.
You think Gruntal's dead? He's got to be dead. Like,
dude, he died. He died for sure. Like his. Oh, in fact, can I read his death paragraph?
Sure. Go for it. Yeah. We got all day.
Segue. All right. This is also how the what we read up to ends. So this is ending, I think, chapter 6. Yeah, yes. Next one's chapter 7. And it is page 280, and it ends the first book. So this is the first last paragraph here. Someone was shrieking, the sound of one dying, and Gruntal understood it at once. Oh, yes, scream your defiance, your terror, and your rage. Scream at that web even as it closes about you. Waves of sound out into the mortal world one last time. The shrieks fell away, and now there was silence, save for the stuttering heart in Gruntal's chest. He knew his eyes were open, yet he could see nothing. Either Corbel Broach's spell of light had failed, or the captain had found his own darkness, stumbling, that heart, slowing, fading, like a pale horse riding away down a road, fainter, fainter, fainter.
Man, That was a pretty brutal scene.
It's so good, but it's also really confusing too.
Dude, honestly, like that death scene was just like so hard hitting because you got into his head and like his last thoughts were like, wow, it'd be really cool if this wasn't drug out the way it's being drug out. Like, this is extremely traumatic. Like, I really don't like the way I'm dying. You know, it's just like so heavy.
He even says, could it not have been so sudden, instant? Yeah, why this lingering, bemused, draining away? And it's like he's kind of sad about it, you know? It just like really catches him unawares. It caught me unawares because I thought it was being developed into a character, which is...
Oh, you don't say. The dinosaurs with swords for arms caught you unawares too?
They came out of nowhere, dude.
Man, Steven Erikson is such a poetic writer. He really is just so good. I mean, damn. I mean, you know, I feel like he gets so much credit for his world building and, you know, the anthropology and archaeology stuff and all that. His ability to build out worlds and build out races and histories and stuff. But like his line-to-line writing is just so damn readable sometimes.
So damn readable. Understandable.
Mm-hmm. Also, I feel like some of these sentences, I'm like, that's a sentence I've just never seen before. And it's not even just because of like terminology that is specific to Malazan. It's just some of his sentences, it's just like, dude, are those even words you can actually put together?
It's like reading the Bible sometimes, honestly. It's like, because it's like written on multiple, everything has different meanings. Like some has a literal interpretation, some has a parable interpretation. Some of it is like analogous, and it's hard to tell sometimes what's actually happening. Like sometimes I'm frustrated because I'll finally understand what's happening in a scene, and then I'll go back and read it. And I'll be like, those words could be interpreted in so many different ways than what's actually happening during this scene. And sometimes I think it removes more from the story than it adds. Overall, I think it adds more, obviously. And it kind of gives it this weight and this epic feel to it and makes it feel like this tome of old. But it does detract from my ability to really comprehend what's happening in the story and thus enjoy everything to its fullest, you know?
I feel like there's a spectrum of specificity and clarity. You know, I think it's
call me on the spectrum.
I'm just saying, like, I feel like there are just moments, and maybe they're intentionally placed, you know, by Erikson. But I feel like there's just moments that seem a little more vague, a little bit more like there's multiple meanings to different sentences and conversations and stuff. And then also there are scenes where it's a dinosaur with swords for arms coming. You know what I mean? Like it's just like this
totally,
is actually
totally.
What's actually
like a rent did literally open in the sky. Yeah,
totally. or like Stani getting jerked off in like a bar, like where everybody's talking. Like that really happened. You know, that was pretty clear. Like what was
there's a lot of hooking up in this book.
There is a lot of hooking up. Like Whiskey Jack and Corlat.
Oh, yeah.
There was like a weird kind of like, whoa, what's going on right here? So I wanted to stick really quickly with all the Gruntal stuff before we moved on to other things. So Gruntal, I thought Gruntal was a really cool character.
Really
interesting. Because he's got like this kind of like, I've been around the I kind of pictured him as like Bronn from Game of Thrones.
You know, okay,
that's how I pictured Gruntal. And then, you know, like his relationship with, I think his name was, Baruch? No, not Baruch.
Baruli?
Well, there's Karuli, who's like the guy in the carriage, the priest, who they're escorting.
Oh,
and then there's Stani and Harald. And then who's the other guy? It starts with a B, who the guy who hooks up with Bashalane and Corbel Broach, who was like an alcoholic for a little while.
Oh,
and then he
totally.
Ways. I can't remember. It was another B name.
It's not Harlow, because that's the other one that dies along with him, who we didn't really get to know as well.
Buke. B-U-K-E. Yeah.
Buke. He came out of nowhere.
Like what was going on is there like a Buke and kind of Gruntal maybe seemed like suspicious that there had been some like killings going on in Darujistan.
That's right.
And he was like, oh, I think it was this Bashalane and Corbel Broach guy. And then so he joined in order to kill
them,
I think.
Yep, totally. Yep.
But then it was such a masterful scene. And I keep coming back to chapter 6 because I just really liked chapter 6. It was like, chapter 5 was just really long, and then like the chapters before that were just like a little boring, or it was like we got the talk stuff where I didn't really know what was going on. And
totally, but 6 was focused and dangerous.
It was like the only chapter so far where we only had one POV the whole chapter, so
totally.
I just really appreciated that. But I really liked the scene leading up to it where Gruntal meets up with Bashalane and Corbel Broach and the manservant guy, I can't remember his name, Emance or something. I can't remember. And Buke, and they had already kind of had a run in with these K'Chain Chimel Krell, and Gruntal's just like, all right, so when they come back, like, we're totally going to kill them all, right? And Buke is just like, no, we're all going to die, dude. Like, yeah, this is, we are not going to survive.
We're not making it through this, my man.
It's like, dude, I saw what we're about. We're about to fight dinosaurs with swords for arms. Like, we don't have a chance.
There's little, like, flexes sewn into the story by Steven Erikson, because, like, he's a, I'm fairly certain, correct me if I'm wrong, Discord, but a pretty well-educated archaeologist. Extremely, and anthropologist, yeah. I believe. And, you know, yeah, he throws around turns like, oh, the, he says, like Buke was another member of the caravanserai or something. And you're like, what the hell are a caravanserai? And, like, that was a roadside inn for travelers to rest alongside the Silk Road back in the day, you know?
Wow, yeah.
I looked that up. I didn't know that off the top of my head. But I was reading it. I was like, what is this?
Another good example of that, just like his attention to detail and especially attention to, like, accuracy, I guess you could call it, with regard to how he's building out these worlds, especially when he's, like, starting chapters and stuff and kind of, like, showing a different location. Like, when we get to Saltoin and he's just like, okay, so the situation with this place is that there was this river that was, like, very good with, you know, there was trade everywhere. And then the river shifted, so they built this bridge over a canal, but that didn't really, like, work out. So the whole city's been kind of, like, in decline this whole time. And it's like, just in a couple paragraphs, you're showing how there's no permanence to any of this. There's no permanence to trade and, like, affluence and you know, everything's just so unstable. Like, there's no predicting, like, what's going to happen and whether or not these empires are going to, or it was like a microcosm almost for just, like, showing how unpredictable this entire world is, you know? Like, we're all just kind of at the whims of, like, nature and what the hell is going on that's totally out of our control. And it was just, like, a couple paragraphs of just describing, like, a canal and a bridge, you know? It's just so freaking brilliant, dude. And then, so there's that. I thought that was really cool. And then, like, when they get into Saltoin, and then, like, hey, dude, he's just so freaking creative, man. Like, I mean, this hallway almost of buildings that has, yeah, like, scrape marks on the sides of it because it's so thin that it would, like, trap wagons in there, and then once the wagons are trapped, it's totally free game, and then, or fair game, and then everybody can come and steal everything. And then, but so there's, like, that, and then Gruntal has, like, this memory,
which I feel like is, like, kind of appropriate, like, maybe, like, Bangkok circa 200 years ago or something, like, you know,
or maybe even, like, some present day stuff. I mean, I don't know, man. Like, I feel like, like, it's just such a good way of showing instead of telling, you know. It's like such a good way of showing, like, you know, the marks on the sides of these buildings where wagons had been stuck before.
Totally. It gives you a texture to the world that you're just, yeah, like, makes you experience, yeah, it so much more, like, viscerally.
Yeah, and I mean, even, like, Gruntal's just like, wow, this city has just really gone to the dogs, you know. Like, this, like, it really is just, it's not what it used to be, and even back then it wasn't much, you know. But I did want to talk a little bit more about Gruntal, and not really Gruntal, but, like, what's the guy's name? Caruli?
Caruli,
the priest,
uh-huh,
guy. What the hell was going on? So, like, okay, so tell me if I'm wrong, and also Discord, correct us if we're both wrong about this, but they're not, like Saltoin is, like, kind of this, like, midway point between Darujistan and Kapistan,
uh-huh,
right? And so they stop there, and I don't know if it was, like, a super planned stop, but when they get there, this woman kind of comes out, and she's, and, you know, Gruntal's like, ah, how much do we have to pay you for you to let us go? And she's like, well, no, we're actually escorting you. And then Karuli's like, well, we're going to meet with the city's leaders. You know, the real leaders. And so then they have, like, this,
he does a straight disinformation campaign while he's in
is
town.
Is that what's going on? Okay.
Yeah, like, for sure.
They have, like, this weird town meeting, and I was like, what the hell is going on right now? He's like, ah, you guys can totally, you can do it. Because there's another interesting part where they find out that, you know, the Panian Domin is coming to Kapistan. Like, that's the next place they want to go. Gruntal is like, hey, person that's paying us to escort you, we don't know if we can get you into this city because, you know, the hard reality of this situation is that there's a giant fanatical army that's about to siege the city. We don't know when they're going to be there.
Totally.
They might get there before we do. And he was just like, nah, don't worry about it. You can drop me off, like, outside the city and I'll totally get in there by myself. It's like, why'd you need the escort then, dude?
Totally.
Like, this, I don't know. I thought, what's up with this guy? You know?
Yeah, it's interesting. And then, like, dude, I don't really understand the Barghest either. I think I have a similar relationship in my brain to them as I do maybe, like, Tisty Andy, into, like, are they, what is a Barghest? Like, I know that, like,
I'm not sure.
Nightshade's, yeah, her boo was a Barghest, and I believe Kaladin Brood, maybe?
Kaladin Brood is half Barghest.
Half Barghest, okay. And then they meet three Barghest on the road, and Karuli's, yep, like, come along.
Also more hooking up.
Yeah, also, yeah, so, like, I really want to know what they look like, because my brain, they were kind of like half orcs, and so that was a really
maybe
I think that's wrong, because like Grendel was, though, you know, who am I to judge Grendel?
I think they're like the kind of like barbarians.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I mean, it's almost like the barbarians of like Icewind Dale.
Sure, totally. Oh, you're totally right.
But I think maybe like non-human too, though.
Right, right. Like, could they bear a child? Oh, obviously, he was half Caladan Brutus, half Barghest. So yeah, totally.
I thought it was really interesting that like they bury some of their dead with like trees that they turn upside down and like stake into the grave and stuff.
Yeah.
And so, like, this forest of like upside down.
Yeah, that was kind of creepy. Just like,
I know. I like the visual of that is just so, man, it's just Erikson is just, it's really interesting, because I feel like a lot of this story, there's so much about this series that treads that familiar Western European medieval epic fantasy territory, but also not even close for like a lot of it too. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah.
I feel like it's just like such a nice mix of stuff that I'm familiar with, like horses and swords and magic and wizards and stuff. And it's very like D&D sometimes. It's very like, it clings very much to its inspiration, but then also, man, like there's just so many things that are like, wow, I've literally never ever seen anything even remotely close. Like, how did you think of this, man? Like, that's
totally
just so different.
Like, we get carriage seats, like the upholstery inside the carriage of the necromancers was like skin, you know, like they're just little details. You're just like, oh,
yeah, details,
crazy
details.
Or like, I don't know, the things that make me annoyed kind of sometimes is when we get things like thrown in there, like the slipstick, is that what it is? Like, and he was a slipstick and it carries on, but like that means that person is a stick made of sticks, like,
yeah,
Hairlock was, but then they're like a character, and I just didn't get that they were just made of sticks. And it's such a weird thing to learn, yeah, later, kind of, once you already have them a person in your head.
It's almost like a lot of this stuff is just so matter of fact that,
yes, yeah,
it all kind of just like blurs together sometimes, and you're like, wait, I think that was actually really important.
Totally.
But like Erikson isn't assigning it much like importance in the text. And so,
right,
you got to be like, wait, what the hell is that?
It was like mentioned again, and I had to look up what a slipstick was. And I was like, this person in my head is like an actual character, and they're actually like a literal stick figure of like tiny little sticks tied together, you know, that like has the soul of a sentient creature nonetheless, but still, you know, different mental image for sure.
I mean, it's interesting, like a Kalor, I didn't put together that Kalor was the same Kalor from like thousands of years ago in the prologue.
It seems too obvious.
I was like, there's no... Really? And it's like, yeah, no, that's actually him. Like,
it really him, yeah, yeah.
It literally is him. He's just there, and he's kind of like a whiny, like angry dude. And it's
super
like,
upset that he can't ascend.
Okay. And then Whiskey Jack like punches him in the face. You know,
yeah,
was it Whiskey,
yeah,
Jack or Dujack?
I can't, yeah, remember. Oh, and he slapped him, I'm pretty sure. I think he slapped him.
Okay, so we talked about Gruntle a little bit. I do want to kind of like go back, move over to Quick Ben.
I was going to say Quick Ben, yeah.
The crippled god. The last book of this series is called The Crippled God.
Oh, wow.
I think we're treading into very read and find out territory here.
Yeah, totally.
I think we're really, it's almost like not even totally worth trying to figure out. I have a feeling, I do think that we should talk a little bit about Quick Ben though, because Quick Ben is so like rattled,
mm-hmm,
by the events in this book, which I thought was really interesting, because he seemed to be pretty like easygoing for most of Gardens of the Moon. And even when Kalam like called him on the rock phone or whatever, in
totally,
Deadhouse
totally.
Case, you know? But also he seemed a little rattled in that conversation, actually, now that I think about it. But the crippled god stuff, here's what I think is going on.
And okay, just, hit me.
So it seems like the crippled god was like pulled down by people and Amanda Rake, I think, maybe. So the crippled god is like in this tent.
Totally.
We can agree on that.
Yeah, and we see a scene with him and Manga
Manug.
Yeah, him. Yeah, yeah, totally. Who gets his legs healed. I will heal you the boils on your leg by making your legs dead. Like, nice, dude. That's what you get for...
And he's just like, sorry.
Making a deal with the god whose literal form of worship is suffering.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, as I was trying to make heads or tails of this before, I felt kind of silly because I think I already messed it up and I don't know what I'm talking about. So I do think it's really interesting that Burn seems to be the whole planet. Am I wrong about that? Like, is that,
I think,
or like most of the planet or something? Or
man,
like,
that's really confusing, kind,
yeah,
of, but it's also a Warren. And it seems like each god is a Warren, because we find out like the Warrens.
I don't think Burn is a Warren.
But like inside the, because like, which is it? Is it Karul that's like his bloodline was the Warrens or something?
Dude, I don't know. We're getting really into the weeds here.
We like, really are. Yeah.
I think that with Quick Ben and stuff, like, we can. I want to shout it out and just say I really liked those chapters. I thought they were really interesting. not super certain about what's going on. It seems like the reason why I think it's so cool is it seems like we're setting up like a very kind of like big bad, like a very big broader stroke kind of situation here that's more than just Malazan. It's more than just the Panian Seer and the Panian Domain and stuff, even though those things are extremely important. It seems like what Quickben is onto regarding Burn and the Crippled God and stuff, that's going to be much bigger fish to fry here pretty soon. I want to find out a lot more about that, but also I don't know what the fuck is going on. Like, I don't know what any of that is. So
Sorry. I think that you're right in this. Like, we don't have the information to know yet, because there's the Warrens are such a it's and I think this is maybe we can put this onto the shoulders of Steven Erikson's habit of making one thing many things, like the Azath houses. Like, those things get used for different elements, totally desperate, some seemingly not even connected, and so do Warrens. Like, you can open one and pull magic through it and seem to do magically attack people and do sorts of magic things
inside of it too.
You can go inside of it, you can travel it, so it's like a physical location. But we find out that it's like all of them were like the blood of a god or something. Like, you're in a god walking through his veins or something. Why do I have that in my head? We learned that last book, I believe.
I think we're gonna have to read a little bit more about that.
Maybe so, man. And then there's like the Warren of Chaos, which seems to be this like kind of fuzzy land between each Warren.
Yeah.
And each Warren, it seems like there's groups of Warrens that like they're in like.
Because there's like elder elder Warrens.
Right.
Like Antos Felek is an elder Warren, I'm pretty sure.
Totally. And the Kitchain Shemal one was like an even older one. And it seems like at the very beginning of the book, we're kind of given maybe a little bit of insight because Tool's sister thinks she's throwing the Jagut kids into the Amtos Felek Warren, right? And she says, like, hoping that it, because she knows that to be controlled by Jagut, who live there, so it would be, like, in their turf. So, like, was the world maybe broken up into these alternate kind of dimensions where each race lived in their own, like, dimension? Is that even... I'm confused, man. Those things are real confusing to me.
Find out later. Figure that out.
Yeah, but I mean, inside, when he gets pulled down by Burn from the... Because he opens up. It's kind of a cool scene because he's like, knows who the Crippled God is. Quickben, once again, opens up all of his Warrens, which is a big deal, that he can even do that in the first place, attacks him, and then quickly gets owned. And then this big hand reaches up, grabs him, and takes him underground. And we see, like, ribs holding up this like chamber kind of alongside with like 15 times the size of men. Yeah. And then he leaves a little rock in there so he can find his way back one day. And the witch in there was like, well, I'll help you, because there somehow all magic will be destroyed if the Crippled God gets his way, because of the way that the Warrens are structured and like the way they're linked. That's what I got. All of it's in danger.
Totally.
All of it. Yeah.
I want to move on a little bit to...
Okay.
I have a question. It's kind of a question amusing, if you will.
Okay.
I want to find out more about the Panian Domain, the Panian Seer.
Yeah.
All that stuff. Because is it... Like, what do you think about it? I mean, do you think that, like...
I know a little bit more about them.
Okay, so don't answer this with spoilers, obviously. But, like, one of the questions I found myself asking is, like, is this the kind of thing where Lassine is playing this situation in a way that we're not aware of? You know what I mean? Like it seems like the Panian Domain just kind of like popped up. I don't know where it came from or like what's going on. I know it's from the south, and it sounds like from the way that the south part of Ginnivacus is described, it's mostly like pirates and bandits, and it's just like a little more like the Wild West.
A little more lawless. Can I just say a sidebar real fast here? So nice to be back on Ginnivacus. Seven Cities is so dry, you know, and just like deserty.
Okay. I like the desert.
I like Ganabak because there's a little more diversity
you know
of terrain
you're
there.
You're not actually in either place, right?
They have Darujistan, the jewel of the north or whatever.
But yeah, I mean, with the Panian Domain and stuff, I feel like one of the things with this book that it's not quite grabbing me as much is like, I just don't know enough about this for it to be really set up in a way that I'm super concerned about it as much as everybody else is. Like, I mean, they do have like the Ten of Squawry or whatever they're called, who are like literally just running around raping and pillaging. So that's awful. They're like eating people and stuff. So it's like almost like, you know, like when you hear horror stories about the other side in a war, but they're like maybe not quite true. But it sounds like this legit. Like they're actually doing that. So that's scary. But with Kaladin Brood and Animator Rake and Dujek and Whiskey Jack and like everybody's just like banding together because this is like such a big problem. And it's like, what's going on? I mean, I don't understand. Like, why is Kaladin Brood like so intent on defeating the Panian domain and the Panian state. I'm not saying that they're not doing anything bad, like they are, obviously, but why does Kaladin Brood like have a stake in it? Like, why does he care?
Totally. You know? I think because everyone has some stake in the Malazan Empire, or at least they don't want the Panian domain to take everything over. And I think that they're seen as a threat, perhaps because these ascendants are so old that they know the types of governments that can really change and take over, do so much damage to an area that it limits their influence on that area. And I think that they're kind of, I get a sense, protecting their own ability to continue playing the game that they're playing, because the Panian Domin aren't even kind of playing it, because they're this very theocratic, like, extremist culture that, like, you're either like a member of the god castle, like a noble who's like a god now, and they, or you're just like a thing, you're nothing, you know, like the Teniscari. Then they're, I mean, some of the crazy blood that we had and like gore that occurred during the last book is like compared to what we have coming to us with the Panian Domin.
Oh, really? Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the Teniscari. I imagine them kind of like...
Okay, so they're really bad.
They're real bad.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's just something that like was trying to be drilled into me, but like I wasn't quite getting it, you know?
I mean, there's so many other things going on, so like why would you even really care about this rumor? But I do think that Steven tried, you know, because like I'm with you.
Sure. It's nothing,
but
sure.
Like he mentioned it multiple times in every book, you know, is like, oh, what's happening down there? And then sent some real big baddies to like go fight him. So that would maybe we would think that they were a big deal. But still, it's kind of like, I get you. It would be nice to have like their expansionist a little bit more like, yeah, they've taken over three cities. What does that actually mean? Like, how worried are we? You know, like very is the answer.
Were the Kachin Chimail like Kroll warriors? Were those like a taste of the Panian domain kind of? Is that like what we were getting kind of?
Maybe.
Here are some of the horrors that are coming out of this. Like, it's just that you can't defeat any of this. It's just like this steamroller that's going to come in and just, it's just untold horrors that you have no chance of against. Like, is that what the point of that was, kind of, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. We're getting rumors and hints of rumors that the Kachin Chimail, Kel Hunters or whatever, allied with the Panian Domin.
Yeah,
and then the Teniscari is like a very bad thing, almost like,
yeah, like fanatical, like,
yeah, like a mob that operates like hive mind, sort of like a hive mind mob that's like almost, they might as well be dead, you know, people just like dogs, like a wow. Pack of dogs. And dude, it's they make me shudder too. Like,
yeah, I know, it's kind of hard to talk about it sometimes because like I like to keep things kind of you know, with some, a little bit of levity and
yeah. And there's one element of the Panian Domin that I won't even, like, we're just gonna avoid it altogether, that they do that. Okay. It's just like, oh gosh. But like, yeah, it's just pretty shuddery. And they're, I think everybody's like, we maybe don't know what we want. We all kind of infight sometimes, but we definitely don't want them in control.
That's,
you know,
that's
kind of what I think
now
is happening here.
In my mind, I was like, what's like, why is the Panian Domin like worse than the Malazan Empire? But it sounds like
they're like the flood.
They're like, actually, oh, that's such a good way of putting it for me. I need it explained like I'm 10 years old drinking Mountain Dew. So like that's what I needed. I needed that. Like, so the Panian Domin is like the flood.
Yeah, totally.
The Malazans are like the covenant.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Kaladin Brood and Co. are like the plucky humans.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Well, and Anna Mandarake and stuff are like, he's like Master Chief, right?
Okay.
Amanda Rake would be Master Chief, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, actually.
Yeah.
Or Kaladin Brood is Master
or
Chief.
Or Kaladin Brood. Yeah, yeah. Totally. Okay.
Well, they're both Master Chief.
Kaladin Brood, tell me if I'm wrong here. He has a hammer that if he drops it, it'll break the world in half.
I guess so.
Like, or if he like misswings like taps the earth, it'll shatter the world, because it did last time and it like knocked out a god's eye or something and like broke a continent.
Man, I want a whole book of Kaladin Brood. I want all Kaladin Brood.
Kaladin Brood, every time he's around Andromeda Rake, he's always like, don't you dare pull out that sword. Like, don't you do it. You know it's evil. He doesn't even like that it's around. He seems to like be annoyed with the sword because it's so evil and whatever. But like, dude, you have a way, arguably way scarier weapon on your, like, how are the leather straps?
Souls,
you've had that checked
like...
recently because it falls off your back. We all die, apparently.
I don't know. It's not trapping souls inside of it, though. And then also has like this other portal to other places inside of that, too. Which is
man, it's really real linked everything, like the chains.
You got Warrens inside of Warrens.
Yeah, and like I don't know, it's hard to think of what the Warrens are. The okay, I know we talked a little bit about Tattersail, but like,
yeah,
at the risk of sounding way too crass, like, how many people are in Silver Fox? Because we've got
I mean, it's definitely Nightshale and Tattersail.
Like, why is Nightshale even there, though? Because
at the time that all of that went down, Betterlin, is that his name? Betterlin, I think it was,
yeah,
his name.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Lover.
Yeah,
I think he's kind of in there too, in a weird way.
No, because Quickben scanned him and was like that he only existed in Nightshield's memory of him. That's where they thought, which was crazy. Why would you even introduce that as an element? Because it's so confusing. I had to read it like 3 times. I'm pretty proud of my understanding of that, actually.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that it's Nightshield and Tattersail, but I think that there might be another couple.
And like she's the mass like bone hunter, right?
Yeah.
So like, but like, I don't know. Neither of those people were amassed, nor was Meeb. So like, I don't understand really how she is an Amass Bone Hunter. Here's another like kind of one that was thrown at us that we see at the very end of the prologue. There's like a wolf and A watching this cursing situation. They're wolves. That's really, but I know that they've been like extinct for a long time and they're maybe ascended. I don't really know. Do you have any light on them to shine?
No idea. I want to read more and find out. Yeah. No
totally. Let's see here.
Maybe delete that part. It's not very interesting.
Yeah, totally. I will.
Okay. So who's this Artenthos guy that was in the meeting with Dujek and Whiskey Jack and one of the Moranth? Also we find out that Crone and all the giant ravens were like born out of the crippled god like falling, and like the and Silver Fox is aware of this.
Totally.
Nightshill, I think, is aware of it. And the like Crone is all upset. Like, I like Crone a lot. Crone is really cool. She adds like a decent amount of humor to everything, even though she's not that funny of a character. It's just like the way that she kind of interacts with everybody.
She's a little like jaded and like kind of seemingly doesn't care. Like, it has more of an animalistic view on things.
She's just been alive for so long.
So long, because she's an ascendant, right?
I don't know if Crone
I'm pretty
is.
Sure she is.
You think Crone's an ascendant?
I think so, yeah.
I don't remember that.
I could be wrong, but I don't know. I just kind of assume everyone's immortal and ascendant these days.
Oh, I have another question. What the hell's up with the table?
I don't
What's
remember
the table
the...
all about?
So I don't remember why Anomander Rake has it in the first place, but I know that he took it from them during some old campaign.
No, Anomander Rake doesn't have it. It's in Kaladin Brood's tent.
Well, yeah, but I kind of think that Anomander Rake and Kaladin Brood are like the same team.
No, they don't like share
a tent.
Yeah.
They're not sharing a tent. But, not sleeping in the same room.
The sappers it was like the sappers table.
Totally. And it was for their deck of dragon games that they were whatever, because it's like specifically for the deck, I think.
Okay, so there's this other faction that's involved, the like irregulars or something, who stole it, because that's like all they do is they just like steal stuff from the Malazans. I don't think it's all they do, but it's a thing that they do. But yeah, like I don't really know what the significance of the table is. Like, is it just like a funny thing that they steal it back? Like,
I think
which
so.
Also, I was like, why are they stealing it back? That seems kind of lame. Like, they're trying to like have an alliance here. Like, it seems weird to like steal. You know what I mean? Maybe I'm missing something.
I think what we did in there is we heard a lot of what the bridge burners were in the first and throughout the book so far, but all we've really seen of them is in like it's them being set up in situations to die. And so we didn't get to see the ones that were with the rest of the army with Dujek. We just got to see a very select one of them. And we're told that they're kind of this like doing goofs, like kind of the fraternity almost of like this brotherhood. And all we really see is them being just like kind of broken and sad. And so I think that's a way to kind of show us of like what their roots a little bit. Like they are kind of this like band of brothers who, you know, does pranks on their fellow soldiers. And like, I don't know. I think they're, that was him trying to just build a little bit of like,
camaraderie,
yeah, totally, yeah. Totally with us and them, and kind of show us not just all this telling, because right now they just seem kind of sad because they've been on the chopping block for so long.
Yeah, that part was like I liked it, but I also didn't really understand like the significance of it. Another thing for the Discord, maybe if there's something you could clear up for me, everybody, because I feel like the table is important. I mean, because like Perrin's face is like etched into it. So I feel like it's important.
I think it was.
Discover a card and they're like, "What the hell is this card?" And then they paint it on the bottom of the table. Wasn't that how the?
I think it just shows up on the bottom of the table because I think the table reflects the deck, and maybe there's some magic in it or something. And so because it confirmed that Perrin was in fact like, "Oh, okay, we're not just making this up. He is a thing there." Because he like walks by and sees it or whatever. It's like, "What?" So I think that was maybe some like latent magic in the wood that just like knew the deck of dragons was getting a new card, and so it changed itself or something. I don't know. I don't know. Let's see if I've got any more. So what do you think is going to happen in old Capistan?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, we can move on to predictions. We've been talking about all this for a while. I mean, obviously, there's so many more things we could talk about, but I want to read more.
It's hard to talk about people talking.
Like, yeah, I feel like we've been on this episode for like a while, but I also feel like we haven't really gotten deep enough with a lot of the stuff. But
totally.
Also, I feel like it's almost a waste of time for me to really dig into a lot of it because we still have so much book left. So yeah, everybody, if this episode seemed really disjointed, it's because it was. Like, we got to read a little bit more to kind of like put some stuff together. So thank you for your patience with that. But yeah, as far as predictions go, I'm not really sure. I mean, I actually, for some reason, I thought Gruntal was going to live through all that, but now that you said it with such finality and like now reading, like going back over, he's dead. Like, that guy's probably pretty dead. I'm kind of bummed out because I kind of want
he
some
just
more.
Seems so. I could have forgotten. I think he's dead, dude. I think he's dead. Could I be wrong? I read it like there wasn't even a chance that he was like, I wish I remembered. It was like a decade ago.
I don't think you read it wrong. I think we just have different opinions on. I like
Steven's ability to trick us and twist.
I just like
words.
Gruntal, so I just did. It's like wishful thinking on my part. I just don't want him to be.
But like, his heart is literally going farther and fainter, and he's like going down. And he had found his own darkness. I don't know, but that just happened to Perrin, and Perrin's back. That happened to Tattersail, and here she is having a nightshade, having to so many people.
So to answer your question about Capistan, though, I mean, it seems like Capistan's gonna fall. Like, they're not, it's like they're divided. Like, the prince, Jerokan or something, is like ruling it. But then there's also like this other council that's ruling it too. There's like a couple thousand soldiers kind of like for the city, and like they're there. And then there's like the Gray Swords, who are like a mercenary company of like another few thousand. It just doesn't seem like it's a very,
like, you know, it's going to be important because we get a map of it.
True. But yeah, I mean, it just doesn't seem like it's a very like stable city. Like, it seems like if the Panian Domain is really this strong, they're going to kind of like bowl over the city. Unless, I mean, I think that towards the end of this book, I'm talking about The Spark in the Ashes, not the whole volume, but like towards the end of this, Kaladin Brood's forces are kind of like mobilizing in order to go defend Capistan. So some kind of big battle. I mean, like, is the Panian Domain going to be like sieging them already? And isn't the Panian Domain kind of like split up also? Like, they're not just focusing like all of their force on like Capistan, right?
No, I don't think so. I think they have like a main horde that's there, but I think they have, yeah, I think they're rather spread out because they're like a whole empire, I think. Or maybe I don't get the idea that they're like Genghis Khan, like one large roving form, and that's the entire nation of them. You know, I think they spread out and take things and keep them, I think.
Yeah, it seems so. To answer your question a little more succinctly, it seems pretty hopeless. Like, I don't see how Capistan's gonna, like, it seems
totally,
like
their internal
Kaladin
Brood's
forces are gonna come up on a city that's basically destroyed, or at least so under siege that there's not much they can do. So I'm interested to see. Maybe something's going to intercede, or like maybe Animator Rake and Kaladin Brood. We just haven't seen quite like, you know, them in like full capacity yet. Maybe,
but we know that there's like Jalarkin, like you said, there's like the Mask Council that's kind of weird, but they've already got some infighting amongst themselves. And I mean, if all of these main players in the Malazan Empire are afraid of these things, it's like, it seems like Capistan doesn't really stand a chance.
But like, what are they supposed to do? Just go back to Jerusalem and like let Capistan fall? Like, I mean, it makes sense.
Totally.
That,
and you need to stop them someplace.
Exactly.
It would be good at like, a place where you have a defensive, like, yeah, totally, totally. That strategically makes sense, though I don't think it's going to, like, mean a lot in the end to Capistan civilians. Maybe it will, I don't know.
So that's what I'm wondering. It's like, maybe something is going to intercede, or maybe Kaladin Brood and Anamander Rake and Dujek One Arm, like, really are just, like, a coalition that can't be beat, which I would love to see.
That'd be sick,
I
mean,
so that's interesting for sure. I mean, it sounds like the Gruntal chapters might be over, so like maybe seeing some new characters.
But then, like, what's the whole point of Gruntal? I think you're actually convincing me that he's not dead.
I don't know, man. He seems like he's alive. Like, it seems like a weird. I mean, what else are? Unless it's to like.
Wow. And like, we've known anything or learned anything, we should not trust Steven Erikson when it comes to a character dying, right? Like,
sure.
Not at all.
Yeah, baby Gruntal ascended.
Like, so
I have
many
no
people
idea.
Come back.
Yeah,
maybe he ascended.
He could have. I have no clue. But yeah, this is definitely for everybody that isn't aware, so this is my third time trying to read this series. The first time I read the first book, and then I got a little bit into Deadhouse Gates. I couldn't get as stopped. And then the second time I did it, I finished Gardens of the Moon and Deadhouse Gates. And then I got to the part that we're about to start. I finished the first book of Memories of Ice and didn't keep reading, so now I am in uncharted territory. Now I know that Chad's not, but Chad might as well be because his memory is
and like okay, 10 years ago. I'm not remembering the details of whether or not totally. Grunt will live, but I mean,
yeah, you might. Definitely in I'm in uncharted territory here. So when I do my predictions, it's just I literally have no idea what's about to happen. Like everything could be in a snow globe in some kid's shelf, and then the rest of the story is about the kid. I have no idea.
I definitely remember some generalities about the story, but man, I lost the time has whittled away the specifics for sure. I remember some like extremely large moments in the stories that I honestly couldn't tell you which book they even occur in, that are like, you know, major, like this story before, the story after moments.
I think that like my overall impression of this book is as much as I'm enjoying the characters, the scenes, Erickson's imagination, the build up, everything. I think everything is just incredible.
Bridge burner fun.
I do feel a little bit kind of like distant. Maybe that's by design or something, but like the idea of like a big like showdown at Capistan, I feel like mentally for me, I'm not quite ready for it yet. Like I'm not really like tied to this land in like an emotional way yet.
Like why are we defending it so hard? Yeah.
Yeah, like I'm just not quite like I feel like I'm very much observing and like not really involved mentally still. So
threat. Once you see the Panion dumb threat for yourself, I think maybe that'll probably become a little bit more solidified inside of your head and be like, yeah, no, we need to defeat this.
I mean, I'm fine with, and I'm not, it's not me being like, oh, we need to make sure that
no,
a bunch of horrible
reason.
Things happen. But yeah, I think that's just like one of my kind of, it's not really even a critique. It's just like where my headspace is at going into the next book in this volume is like, I definitely feel like my brain is a little bit rattled and I'm just kind of like with Deadhouse Gates, I was a lot more locked into like Felicin and Haboric, and I was locked into Fiddler and Absalar and Crocus because I'd already been around them for the book before this. And like,
totally. It's a continuation of a natural progression sort of thing.
Yeah. Like Mappo and Ikariam, I was like emotionally invested in that relationship a lot more. I was just more emotionally invested in Deadhouse Gates earlier on than I am in this. I mean, Whiskey Jack and company, I'm definitely pretty emotionally invested, I would say.
Totally. But yeah, it's harder to have that with a whole army of people as opposed to just like these groups like of two or three that are struggling together, you know?
But I mean, there are, we are zooming in quite a bit on this too, though. So
definitely we are. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know how you would maneuver all these pieces without having multiple meanings and a lot of talking. And I think that, if there's one thing I know that about Steven Erickson is like the last 200 to 300 pages of his books are always just like, wow. Cause he really has like, as a writer has like this, if I have forced you to get this far, I'm going to make it worth it. Like he's really into the payoff idea as an author. And so anything he never fails to produce for sure. Now, okay. Is before we wrap up here, what is happening? Cause the timeline is this book starts about 2 months after the Lady Simtal's fate. So has Felicin and them even been freed, or are they still working in the mines now?
I think these books seem to happen around the same time.
Yeah.
Like I could be wrong about that, but I think
you're right. You're right.
And Memories of Ice are like, and I think we might see that also with. And I could be totally wrong about this, but I've heard that the next book, House of Change, we go back to Seven Cities. And then in Midnight Tides, we go back to Genebacus.
Oh, okay. We kind of flip-flop. I do remember that, actually. Yeah.
But yeah. And I don't know. I'm really excited to see what happens. I want to see more of the Moranth.
I want to learn what Lady Envy's all about and why she wants to get on talk.
She does want to get on talk.
She wants to talk so bad. But who wouldn't? He's like a cool guy.
Yeah. That's charming. But yeah, I want to find out more about what all that is and I don't know what's going on. They're in a place called Morn, which... Are they on like this plane of existence? Like, are they not in a Warren? I thought they were in a Warren. Is there a rent just like around down there?
I think
like,
so.
Has it been there for a really long time? Like, no one's mentioned it.
Morn is the city of the Kachin Chamal, right?
It's on the bottom coast of Genebacus.
Okay. And
it's like 600 miles away from Daruzistan or something like that. It's
totally,
like,
totally. Yeah. It's on the southwestern coast of Genebacus. And it is the location of the rent, the Torn Warren. So,
we'll find out more.
The hole in the sky down there, apparently, that you should not throw children into. I sometimes wonder as we wrap up here, not to finish with more questions and things I don't know, but like, I wonder if we're not told certain things because they just aren't important anymore, such as why the Amass seem to committed genocide on the Xagu, because they clearly have some sort of mercy in them, right? They're like, when they find out what's happened and where the Tool Sister is taking these two children, they're like, we wouldn't even wish that fate upon our enemies. And they go to prevent him or her from doing that, because she knows it'll be suffering for these kids. They just want to kill them. So it's like, why? You want to kill them?
Yeah.
That seems crazy. You want him to kill children, but like also there seems merciful at the same time. It's hard to hold both of things, those things in my head at the same time. And so I'm wondering about their motivations, because this was also mentioned to be the 33rd war between the two races.
Seriously.
So.
And they want to have more.
Yeah. And they had just recently joined forces to take out Raist. So like, I don't know. I don't really understand.
Yeah, but that was like a marriage of convenience kind of thing.
Totally.
Or necessity, I should say. But I think that to your question though, I mean, like, I think everything's just important, which it's a really awesome part of this series. It's also kind of a frustrating part of this series, is it's just so much to hold in your head.
Yeah.
But I think
this is the way I say maybe it doesn't matter.
The advice that I've seen on social media from a lot of people that are followers of ours and have commented on a lot of my videos and stuff, they're mostly just like, hey, don't worry about it. Just enjoy the ride. Trust that Erickson knows what he's doing. Trust that some stuff isn't going to make sense. I mean, I'm getting a lot more comfortable with this series. I think like our jokes about how it doesn't make as much sense. I think we'll probably start making fewer and fewer of those. I think we're going to fall into a good rhythm with these. I think that
totally. We don't need to understand like the motivations of a war that happened 300,000 years ago to understand what's happening in today. But yeah, I get what you're saying too. Like I would like to,
but dude, like you wanting to is so valid. I mean, like I want to understand that. I think that the way that Erickson's putting this all together, though, is like just as if you were studying the whole history of the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, the Ottoman Empire, or whatever. It's so complicated. Like there's so much going on, and you really need to know certain things before you know certain things, even if you've heard of certain things. You know, it's like there's a big difference between hearing about something and understanding something. You can hear about something before you have more awareness or knowledge of that thing. So I think that he's like reflecting that. He's saying like this is a big miasma of different events, and it is a big giant blender full of terminology and history and people and stuff, but that's what everything is. I mean, that's what this situation is.
Behind or under every rock, there could be some powerful entity just being locked away that you accidentally release. Man, we've had a lot of that, you know?
Mm-hmm. All right. That's it for me. Yeah, I'm going to go read some more of this.
Release these two powerful entities.
Hey-o. Everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode. First book in the third volume. A little confusing, but I think Chad and I, we dipped our toes in and got a chance to talk about some cool stuff. Hopefully there's a little bit more for us to kind of dig into, you know, like philosophy wise and
yeah, let's hope Gruntle makes it.
I hope Gruntle makes it.
Me too.
I want to see some more from Quick Ben for sure. I love Quick Ben. I want more Whiskey Jack. I want Whiskey Jack to slap somebody else in the face. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know if that was Whiskey Jack or Dujack. Anyway, we'll see you all for the next episode, which will be what's the next episode called?
It is called, I've got the book right here. It is called Hearthstone.
Hearthstone.
Which is the thing in World of Warcraft, which would make you go down to your inn of choice, right? Your home base inn, beam you there. I think that's what it is, right? It's like a stone for your hearth. So it represents home.
I never played Warcraft.
It's good stuff.
I don't know. You're not going to convince me.
No, don't do it.
So yeah, like I said, everybody, again, thank you so much for listening to this episode. We hope that it helped you along your Malazan journey. It certainly helped me. I mean, every time we do one of these episodes, I go into the next book with so much confidence, and I feel like we really, like, I know a little bit more about what's going on, or at least I feel a little more comfortable not knowing about stuff.
Totally.
So,
awesome. I feel like Steven Erickson can make you feel dumb sometimes as a reader alone, and when you find out other people, like, it's nice to hear you be like, sometimes I just don't know what I'm like, cool, because I don't either, and I just want to make sure that it wasn't a me thing, and that's why I don't think it is.
And that's what we get in the Discord too, everybody. I mean, we get a whole lot of like validation and explanations for things too. So if you're not in the Discord, definitely join it. We have two Discord channels for the Book Reviews Kill, like Malazan stuff. We have one Discord channel that is for where we're at in the read through. We don't do any spoilers past that.
And events discussed up to,
And events discussed up until that. And we also have another channel that's for general Malazan discussion. Everybody's still tagging spoilers, but they're talking
about
Malazan.
People
want to
make fun of us because you read the sixth one.
You can make fun of us in there too. Yeah,
totally. Yeah, please do.
Chad and I are not at all pretending to be a Malazan podcast. We are two people that have a podcast that are just happening to read Malazan, so...
And doing a pretty damn good job of it, if I do say so myself.
We're trying our very best. We're trying our very, very best. If you want, you can go on Reddit and tell everybody how dumb we are. It's totally cool.
Totally fine.
I'm sure everybody will agree. I'm having a good time.
Go to our Patreon first, though. The more you, the higher rank of Patreon member you choose to be, the more we're cool with you making fun of us on Reddit forums. So, yeah.
I think that's perfectly fair.
I think that's perfectly fair, too.
100%.
Yeah. Reasonable position to have.
We should we could have like a $1,000 tier mode where you can like just gossip about us and tell everybody how stupid we
Give
are.
Give them like an AI so they can do deep fakes sometimes.
Why would people pay for that when they can do it for free?
I know, for real. Make fun of us for free.
Okay, that's it. We're ending the episode.
Let's do that.
Right now.
Let's go read.
This is the end of the episode. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. Hope you have an amazing rest of your day. And of course, happy reading.
Bye, everybody.